Joining me now to discuss the latest federal issues affecting us locally is Member for Barker, Tony Passon. Thanks for joining me, Tony.
Pleasure, Jenny.
You were at the up-and-coming Thomas Foods site yesterday for an industry launch of a campaign called More to Meat Than Meets the Eye. What was this all about?
Well, this was a campaign that's being launched by the Australian Meat Processors Corporation to remind Australians and communities, particularly regional communities right around Australia, of the importance of the meat processing sector. 138,000 people are employed in the sector across 300 regional communities. For a long time, that sector has been a bit shy about its achievements, and it's an opportunity to run a campaign to remind Australians that buying Australian red meat in particular is something you can do to support local industries.
Absolutely, and I suppose there's quite a few knock-on effects that it has in regional areas, like through the Murraylands.
Yeah, well, you know, not only is there 138,000 people employed directly, there's hundreds of thousands of people indirectly employed, and on top of that, these processing facilities support primary producers right across the country. We understand in Murray Bridge, of course, the importance of processing facilities like the one that's being rebuilt in Murray Bridge by TFI, because we've experienced what happens when it's taken away from you quickly, as it was in January 2018. So we get it. We just want the rest of Australia to get it.
And one of the topics of discussion was the threat of foot and mouth disease from coming in from Indonesia, something you've been campaigning pretty hard on since that reared its head.
Yeah, this is a ever-present risk, but one that's been heightened in recent months, particularly now that foot and mouth is uncontrolled in Indonesia and in Bali. 1.2 million Australians visit Bali on annual basis, and the likelihood of FMD arriving on Australian stores has gone from about 9% chance to 11.6% chance. That's heading in the wrong direction. The real concern is that were it to arrive in Australia, equally were lumpy skin disease, which is also endemic across the Pacific, to arrive in Australia, that would immediately cut off our export channels, which means about there'd be no home for about 70% of the meat we produce. So it doesn't bear thinking about. It's been calculated at about an $80 billion loss. And so, you know, I'm asking if it's good enough for every parcel that comes to the country to be inspected from these hotspots, why aren't we opening every piece of luggage? Because, you know, we saw a couple of weeks ago some muppet thought it was a good idea to bring back a Macca's Happy Meal from Indonesia. I mean, just people aren't thinking about the long-term consequences, and that's why we should have stronger biosecurity measures at our borders.
Do you think they are at the level you've been calling for yet? I mean, obviously they're not opening all pieces of luggage. They finally have those sanitation mats and things like that. What do you reckon?
It's been slow, Jenny, and we're now at the third tranche of measures. I would have been happy if those measures were implemented immediately. They weren't. You know, we're on Team Australia here. Nobody wants FMD to come in, and I think we need really strong measures. And I just think when I ask the question, why aren't we inspecting every piece of luggage, the answer I was given is that would cause inconvenience for travellers. You know, it begs the question, we'll have a think about the inconvenience to primary producers were this disease to arrive on our shores. I mean, I'm sure people, if they want to go to Bali, can factor in the fact that it'll be a 2 or 3 hour wait while their luggage is inspected. Big deal. Or alternatively, go to another country for your holiday. I mean, it's just not a risk worth taking, in my view. And, you know, and I think my fears were confirmed when that Happy Meal was found. I mean, who knows what else has been coming into the country in that luggage that's not being inspected.
With us at the moment is Member for Barker, Tony Passon. Let's switch tracks now. You've backed Party Leader Peter Dutton's call for an inquiry into nuclear. The Royal Commission, though, suggested nuclear would be too costly to explore as an energy source in Australia. Why do you reckon we should go down that path now?
Well, to be really clear about what we're saying, Jenny, so we're saying that there needs to be an honest, robust conversation about nuclear energy as part of the energy mix, and until we have that conversation, we can't say with any certainty whether in fact there has been or it is an expensive form of technology. There's a prohibition on the development of nuclear technology in Australia, which would need to be lifted. But we've got to have a conversation about whether that is in Australia's best interests, and we want to have that conversation. Comparable economies around the world are using nuclear power to firm up their energy grid. We've never really needed to do that in Australia because we had such plentiful reserves of coal, which we could use to generate electricity very cheaply, much, much cheaper than nuclear technology. But now that we are, you know, heading towards a decarbonised future, and given that coal's, perhaps against my better judgment, being driven out of the system, we need to find a baseload replacement, and one that's CO2 sensitive. And what better than a carbon neutral form of technology like nuclear? So having a conversation about this, I think, is an important thing to do, and it can't just be a simple statement, we're for nuclear, we're not for nuclear. It's a policy position that says we need to have an honest, detailed and robust conversation in our nation about whether nuclear technology can form part of the energy mix going forward.
Yeah, we got a text message from someone who heard you and I are going to be having a chat about this, who says the total amount of uranium used per person for their entire life would fit into a beer can, which is an interesting comment. And they ask, would we have the capacity to use coal-fired power stations that have been discontinued as nuclear power stations? Is that part of the discussion?
Well, all things are on the table in terms of how we transition, if we were to transition. But I do remind people all the time that it seems incongruous to me that we mine and export uranium to the rest of the world to use in energy, nuclear energy generation, and yet we rule out the prospect of doing that in Australia. I think equally it's important to note that we're not talking about a 1960s-style Chernobyl reactor. Next generation or third generation nuclear reactors, you know, just like you ought not compare a car built in 2020 to one that you might have been driving in 1960. So it's about time we had this conversation. In fact, it's overdue for us to have this conversation in Australia, and we're backing the need to have the conversation and to have it without the hyperbole and make sure it's a very clear debate about where we want Australia's energy mix to be over the course of the next 50 years.
I mean, yeah, it's certainly one that would take... some people would never budge on their position that they're concerned about safety, having seen in history things like Chernobyl. Yeah. So that's another challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, but equally, if we're going to be real about that, then why are we exporting uranium to the rest of the world? So, and obviously we do that because the technology's safe, and I think your listeners would be gobsmacked at how many nuclear reactors there are around the world, including increasingly small modular reactors. So I think I've always been supportive of a technology, not taxes approach to this. I'm honestly, Jenny, I'm completely technology agnostic. My focus has always been on affordable, reliable electricity, because I'm actually the person who sits down with people at their kitchen table who tell me that they can't afford to keep the heater on in wintertime. So my focus has always been unashamedly on affordable electricity, because some of the poorest Australians live in my electorate, and I want to make sure they're warm in winter.
With us at the moment is Tony Passon, member for Barker. I hear you're calling for clarity on the Murray-Darling Basin plan.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear. Are we going to deliver the 450 or not? Are we going to deliver the plan in full or not? Are we going to deliver the plan in full and on time or not? Because all these things are topics on which the newly minted in Federal Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek has been a bit inconsistent on. So I think people who earn a living irrigating from the river deserve a degree of certainty. And right now I want to know, are we pursuing a buybacks agenda, which was what the Labor Party campaigned for? Are we going to achieve the 450, or are we walking away from it? Because within the course of 2 weeks, Tanya's had two different positions on this very important question. We just need clarity for irrigators and river communities generally.
And I understand you've questioned the stats, the 2 gigs that has been delivered over that time in the best part of the decade.
What do they say? Damn lies, and statistics. I mean, the reality is we have gone on a very strong water recovery trajectory. In fact, the single largest irrigation licence holder in Australia is now the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder. Now, that couldn't have happened if all we'd recovered was the 2 gigs. The reality is the additional water, the additional 450, is always going to be the most difficult water to secure. But to suggest that in somehow we've, in prosecuting the plan, in delivering the plan, we've only recovered 2 gigs, just being dishonest with the Australian people.
And you mentioned, you know, I understand the Coalition isn't a fan of buybacks, although there is some evidence that it does deliver more environmental water. Why do you think buybacks kill communities?
Well, if your community relies on irrigated horticulture to sustain its economy, if you take the water away from an irrigation business, you have no business. And that's what we saw in the first round of buybacks during the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd era. The communities in around the Riverland who rely on irrigated horticulture literally shrank. They were decimated. It kills communities. We have to be much more nuanced about water recovery. I'm a huge fan of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. I want to see it delivered in full and on time. But I'm equally cognizant that the 450 additional water includes a socioeconomic neutrality test. So that was inserted into the plan to make sure that river communities weren't killed off by the process of recovering water. So in order to recover this water, we need to do it in a way that doesn't impact communities. There are ways of doing that, water efficiency programs, infrastructure investment. Those are all things that come at a significant cost, much more expensive than buying water, but at least then you maintain that consumptive pool of irrigation water which supports communities. Simply ripping the water out of communities and putting it in the non-consumptive pool achieves your goal, but unfortunately it smashes communities in the meanwhile.
I really appreciate your time today, Tony Passon. Thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Jenny. Thank you.